On Sunday at Lord's, England will play their first Men's Cricket World Cup final for 27 years and their first live match on free-to-air television since 2005. Speaking after the thrashing of Australia at Edgbaston, Owen Morgan admitted the prospect of playing in a World Cup final seemed laughable following their abject performance 4 years ago. Now they are just one victory away from a first World Cup title. Standing in their way are Kane Williamson's dogged New Zealand side, the beaten finalists 4 years ago in Melbourne, who broke Indian hearts in the semi-finals. Like England, the Kiwis have never lifted the trophy. Something has got to give on Sunday. Welcome to the Wisden Cricket Daily Podcast World Cup Final Preview in partnership with Travel Bag, creating holidays packed full of memories since 1979. I'm your host, Joe Harmon. Later in the show, we'll be hearing from Kiwi reporter Andrew Alderson, who tells me World Cup fever is gripping New Zealand. But first, joining me on this sunny afternoon at the Oval is Daniel Norcross of Test Match Special fame. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Joe. It's lovely to be back.
And for the first time on the show, I'm delighted to be joined by the Independent's chief sports writer and new dad, Jonathan Liu. Hi, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me. Hi, how's it going?
Good, good. How's it been juggling a World Cup and a new daughter?
It's weird. I've actually covered very little of the World Cup, but I've seen a huge amount, because when she's baby Astrid is kind of pinned to your knees, you know, and you're sitting on the sofa and you can't move, the only thing to do really is watch 8 hours of cricket. So I've seen that Pepe's advert probably about 200 times now.
And now they've got a bit of free extra advertising as well, so it's all paying off for Pepe's.
If you want to send some through to Stockwell, by all means, anyone from Pepe's listening,
I'm sure they're all tuning in. So yesterday was kind of extraordinary. England produced the perfect performance pretty much when they needed to. I'm still kind of coming down from it a bit, really. Everything they tried pretty much came off, didn't it?
It was absolutely extraordinary. They found the corporeal form of Australian cricket and slaughtered it, and then they took out the meat from the bones and minced it, and then stuck it in a very English pie, like a cottage pie, and then feasted on it with English condiments such as HP sauce and mustard. And it was the most English day of all possible days. There was nothing for Australia to get any kind of pleasure from at all. Their best batsman laboured over what looked an important, but in the end was pointlessly futile, 86.
And they got nutmegged
in rather humiliating fashion as the ball, I think, may have slightly clipped his groin on the way through to the stumps, possibly slowing him down by the fraction of an inch that was required to see him humiliatingly depart the scene. Their most exciting new prospect of this tournament, Alex Carey, got smashed in the face and was bleeding all over the pitch. I mean, that was sort of reminiscent of Ponting and Harmison, wasn't it, a little bit of 2005? And it was so unexpected, really. I mean, I don't know whether it was a toss. I don't know what Jonathan thinks. I don't know whether the pitch might have had just a little bit more bite in it, and it was a good toss to lose, because the received wisdom was that you're going to bat first at this stage of the tournament.
I would have batted as well.
But actually, England's bowlers looked like they got a little bit more response on the pitch at that time of day than Australia did later on.
It's weird to think that kind of yesterday morning, as an England fan, like all England fans, I felt really nervous about it. Especially when Australia won the toss and batted, as it turned out, it feels like it was one of the better wickets in the tournament to chase on, because there was a lot of movement out there at about 10:30, and there wasn't so much at 2:30. And I think Dan makes quite a good point. It felt a really English day, and in the column that I'm about to file and almost certainly almost finished for the Wisden Cricket Monthly, I'm going to talk about how it's felt like a very global, it's not felt like an English tournament. They've tried sort of little sort of accoutrements at the ground, but whether you're watching on telly or you're in the ground, it's felt like a global tournament, especially the multicultural nature of a lot of the crowds. Yesterday felt like the first proper English day, and it felt like England's tournament for the first time. I don't know whether that's a portent or a positive omen, but you know, with the songs in the crowd, the kind of the football style chanting, it felt like an English World Cup in a way that hadn't really.
When you were watching on the sofa with your new baby, as England lost a couple of games in succession, did you feel like this was heading towards a calamitous end, or did you have faith that England would pull it back? Because it's not just that victory yesterday. If you see this as part of a trio, with the win against India, the win against New Zealand, and then against Australia, three extraordinary performances to pull out under pressure in the way that they have.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about covering lots of different sports is you get acquainted with lots of different flavours of English World Cup disaster, and you know, whether it's football or rugby union or rugby league or even the World Cup of darts, which England once got knocked out in the second round by Spain. This is
oh my word,
Phil Taylor.
I didn't know that.
If there's one sport you expect England to win a World Cup in, it's Phil Taylor and James Wade, world's number one and two, and they lost to a pair of Spanish amateurs, one of whom was nicknamed El Dartador. he's actually not bad. He's become a pro since. He's pretty good. But you get used to England screwing these up, and you kind of recognize the signs. You kind of read the runes. And had this been a regular World Cup tournament, 6 or 7 game pool stage, that's how it would have ended. But in fact, the elongated nature of the group stage allowed them to have a big dip and then build up their momentum again, and so here we are.
And you wrote that only in a Cricket World Cup could a player tear his hamstring and recover and come back to play a lead role in the tournament, and that's obviously Jason Roy has done that, and was just incredible yesterday, wasn't he? Because he started in quite a measured way. We were saying this before the start, 50 for none after 10 overs is actually quite slow by England standards, and then having settled himself in, just launched himself at the spinners, didn't he?
They're never 50 for none. They're either 35 for 4 or they're 75 for none. So it was almost like they found plan C, and they bypassed plan B, which was completely useless, and went straight for plan C, which is what everybody's been after. And it was really measured. It was really clever batting that first 10 overs when you've got a target of 224, especially with these white Kookaburra balls and against Stark and Cummins and Behrendorf. That's the threat. Stoinis and Lyon were unlikely to be the threat. So they recognised that threat and at the same time put away what were a few bad balls. I mean, they drove, as they always do, gloriously through the covers. I managed to thread the half volleys through the covers. That was all fine. But it was the fact that they didn't go ballistic. They didn't lose their shape. They didn't lose their sense of proportion of what was required. And then once they got to 50 for none, all the tension sort of fell out of the game, didn't it? And that was, I think, what was the most... We talk about it being an English day, it was. In all those sorts of ways, and the World Cup for me has been about Pakistan and Bangladesh and Indian fans, and who have made the games raucous and different and have a different noise to them. But what was really un-English about yesterday was they won a semi-final at a canter with 107 balls to spare. There was no drama, there was no edge of your seat stuff. It wasn't just that they won it, it was the game that every England fan feels that they deserve, that they probably don't really want deep down. They like the drama, they like the plucky losing.
There's something a bit unsettling about it.
It was unsettling. At halfway, I'll tell you now, that in the commentary boxes, people like Michael Vaughan, everybody really was saying 250 will be really hard. And when they kept them to 223 as well, that's England are on top, but that first 10 overs could be crucial. And it just, maybe the first 10 overs were crucial and England just batted really well, but it felt like they could have chased 300.
Yeah, it was too perfect. I don't want to be kind of Downer McGee here, but there were kind of shades of 2004 Champions Trophy semi-final, and the suspicion is that they're going to get Ian Bradshaw big time on Sunday.
So who's the Ian Bradshaw? That's what, kind of a Matt Henry coming in at number 9 for New Zealand.
Mitchell Santner maybe.
Yeah, so it's all set up for Santner to win it with 43 off 70 balls.
Yeah. So well, I don't think New Zealand will be pushed over in the way that Australia were. New Zealand have come out on top in four really close games, which they easily could have lost, they've won. They're a pretty dogged outfit, and Kane Williamson is going to take some shifting, even if the openers might not.
Well, that's true, and Lords is different as well. I don't know if Lords suits England's bowlers as well as Edgbaston does. I think there's a little bit there that could be tricky. I'm not sure now. I'd be rather confused after what happened to Edgbaston. If they win the toss, they're going to bat, they're going to bowl. I mean, what do you do? At Lords, it's always this look up, not down business. I don't think anybody knows. I think it would probably be preferable for Owen Morgan if he lost the toss again.
Take
it out of his hands, yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to look at a couple of the matchups, the big matchups. One, obviously, the big comparison is Root v Williamson, the two number threes, the two premier batsmen in each team. So Williamson scored 548 runs in this tournament. Root scored 549. They've gone about in very different ways because of the team they've got around them. And so the last four times Root has walked out to bat after the Roy Bairstow partnership has been broken, the scores read 128, 160, 123 and 124. The last four times Williamson's walked out to bat, the scores read 5, 29, 2 and 1. I mean, he might as well be opening the batting side.
I don't think he's come in after the 10th over all tournament. I was looking it up for a piece on Tuesday.
The Sri Lanka game. They had a decent opening partnership in that, but maybe that was...
I don't think he didn't come in, did he?
They won by 10 wickets. They won by 10 wickets, of course, yeah.
And three times he's had to come in the first over, and against India, I think it was a third over. He is essentially their opener, and I think his strike rate for the tournament is something like 77, which is kind of very Michael Bevan 1999 World Cup.
Jonathan Trott style.
Yeah, it's Jonathan Trott. Yeah. And that's the role that he's been forced to play. Whether the rest of his teammates have it in him to actually give him a proper platform for once. You might actually get to see, you know, some of the free-flowing Kane Williams that we see in the IPL. But it's interesting that he's, you know, we've not really seen everything that he can do, and yet he has been by far and away their key player.
And part of that is because Martin Guptill just hasn't come off at all, hasn't scored a half century since the start of the tournament. McCullum said he's the one that really sets the tone. He decides what totals New Zealand can get, and then Williamson has to adapt to how he goes. But the way Archer and Wokes bowled with a new ball at Edgbaston, Guptill's not going to have it any easier than he's had. Well, he's going to have it harder than any other stage in the tournament, possibly.
No, but, you know, the thing about form and all that is Guptill's a very good player. We've seen Guptill score loads of runs, see him score loads of runs against
England. He has that run out going round and round his head as well to get Dhoni and effectively win that game for them.
Yes, I mean, you just don't know, do you? We speculated so much throughout this World Cup, and I, for one, have been wrong about almost everything. I was wrong about the likelihood of the pitches yielding loads of runs. I was wrong about the West Indies, who I thought would push for a place in the semi-final. I've got the other three right, but I didn't have Australia in my semi-final lineup. So I was wrong about Australia. I was wrong about the West Indies. Wrong about pitches. I've been wrong about what you should do if you win the toss. It's just the one.
So who's going to win on Sunday?
I think there's still time for India to come rocking back.
They will find a way. Like the DRS will kind of. Yeah, we'll play up, or there'll be some kind of administrative glitch, and you know,
wrong team's been invited to the final.
Well, Kohli was pushing for an IPL style thing where the team who topped the group got two stages.
I like
two
that,
attempts
though.
To, yeah,
I mean, I know
a bit late
people,
in the day
know,
to be I'm, suggesting it. I think
I know,
it's quite
I know
convenient.
People are saying it's sour grapes and that, but actually,
the question was put to him as well. Actually,
yeah,
he didn't come out,
and I quite like it, because if you have this attenuated process for deciding who's going to be in the top four, you might as well at least make sure that the teams who are fourth, third, second and first are fighting for a reason to be first and second. You know, not just that you're going to play the fourth best team. I like that as a method, but I just think this whole tournament has been surprisingly unpredictable. I think we thought that Sri Lanka were abysmal, and they probably were, but they came surprisingly close to qualifying. I think we thought that Pakistan were hopeless after a couple of weeks, and actually once they realised what their best side was, they then went on a winning streak, won the last four. We thought New Zealand were really good, and then they went on a massive losing streak.
Very good.
We thought England were hopeless, and then there was no way that they could beat three of the teams above them, and then they have done that with some ease, in actual fact. So I don't know. Obviously, on podcasts like this, we're expected to make predictions, but I'm extremely wary of doing it now because I've just been proved an idiot.
What's the advantage of doing a daily one, though? You can just move on to the next one and forget what you said. If New Zealand are to turn over England on Sunday, how are they going to do it? Is it just the blueprint that they had against India, that you basically, if they bat first, they don't necessarily aim for a particularly massive total, and then just hope that their bowlers can restrict England?
Yeah, I mean, I can't really look past the new ball as what's going to do it to them. I mean, you talk about matchups. I think Lockie Ferguson against Owen Morgan's a huge one, because Morgan's short ball, I mean, whether it's a thing or it's not a thing, you know, people are making it a thing now. And, you know, he's going to get a barrage. And if England bat first and it's 10:30 and sort of Bolt is, you know, Bolt and Henry are kind of charging in, and they get, you know, 10 for 1, 10 for 2, it's suddenly anybody's game. And what we've seen in certainly a lot of the recent games, that the first 5-6 overs are proving so decisive. And like same in the 2015 final, actually, with McCullum getting bowled by, cleaned up by Stark. Those early skirmishes can set the tone in a game that big.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can sort of lose a game, can't you, at 5-3? I mean, that's sort of when India lost a game, and they lost Sharma and Kohli early. And Australia yesterday, in retrospect, you know, 14-3, wasn't it? That meant that they had to bat in a certain way, and England had really won that game, despite the nervousness and agitation that goes with England being in the semi-final. But you can also win a game the other way, which is the way England have done it with their batting, which is to be 120 for none.
It'll be fascinating to see how Roy and Bairstow go at Butler. They are prepared to sit in, because they're both in such fantastic form, it must be tempting just to keep going.
Yeah, but I think the other part of it is, look, they know that New Zealand have got not quite the support bowling of other sides. So they know that there are pickings to be had. If you see off Bolt, Bolt's quite a long spell first up, often bowls 6 overs first up.
Yeah.
So that makes it a little bit more awkward, because they don't want to lose those power play overs to Bolt. But if he's not making inroads, then that is a huge headache for Williamson, because Santner's not a great turner of the ball, and England's batting against spin has been absurdly good. I mean, they destroyed the Indian spinners at Edgbaston, I know Steve Smith's not the perfect example, but Lyon and Smith yesterday, when Lyon came on, his first ball, Roy hits him for six. There's no looking at him. He's hit Steve Smith for three sixes in a row. And the first one was nearly caught at long on. It didn't stop him. So there's a fearlessness about the way they'll play Santner as well. And then Jimmy Neesham, you know, so the batsmen have actually got more of an incentive to dig in a curious kind of way against Bolt because they know what's to come.
I think Ferguson is key in that, as you say, that Morgan matchup. Also, when England beat New Zealand in the group stage game, Ferguson wasn't fit for that game. Southee played his first game in the tournament and was nowhere near his best. I mean, yeah, just looked very, very hittable. And New Zealand looked flat in those middle overs, but that's what Ferguson's given them always for this tournament, that when Bolt's generally taken wickets at the top, Henry as well, Ferguson comes in with that kind of blast in the middle overs and generally has picked up wickets.
Yeah, I mean, I think we will find out what Morgan and this team are made of if he wins the toss, because you can lose a game, you can lose a final in the first 10 overs. If you're 20 for 4, that's it, forget it.
Yeah.
But equally, you win the toss, you bat, you score 330, you win. And if that's what Morgan does, if he wins the toss, bat first. The safe option is to put them in, see what a good total is,
yeah,
and then try and chase it. If he wins the toss and says, "All right, go out, get 350, and win the World Cup," we'll kind of know that their fearless attitude is something that they're prepared to carry through into a World Cup final. That's really the test of it, isn't it?
It is, and it would be consistent to say we're going to put the runs on the board with what England done for the last 4 years. And Morgan does stick to his guns generally. I mean, it a lot of. It's not just hot air with Morgan, it's thought through.
I also think that it's easier to be fearless, weirdly, in a final than a semi-final, because I think for the England players, this is about fulfilling your potential, was to be at Lord's, was to go through the whole journey. There are other bits that go with that, like free-to-air television, it being on Channel 4 and all that sort of stuff. Once you're at that final, then I think it's easier to convince yourself to go for it. The fear is going to come in a semi-final, and I think they got a bit fortunate that Australia won the toss. They got those wickets, and that meant that they didn't really have a chance to be tested, their fear to be tested. Now they're there, I think they'll say to themselves, well, look how we chased that down. You know, we did that through aggressive batting after the first 10 overs. We got there before against India by really going for it at Edgbaston and taking out their spinners. I would be surprised if they don't come out and go hell for leather on Sunday.
I was talking to Steve Waugh earlier this week. Massive name drop there. But he was talking about the 99 experience, because obviously they came through an incredibly draining semi-final against South Africa at Edgbaston, and he was saying that rather than it kind of mentally tiring them out, they felt so much relief at winning that semi-final. And South Africa, I think, had beaten Pakistan sort of 11 times out of 13 previously. They think, right, well, we're actually through the tough part now. Getting here was a tough part, and now all you got to do is just play your natural game. And it took a lot of the pressure off coming through the semi-final, and they could go into that final against Pakistan with a kind of abandon, a professionalism, you know, that had been lacking, I think, in the sort of the slightly sketchy progress to the final.
I said at the start of this tournament, slightly tongue-in-cheek, that the worst thing that could possibly happen is that England arrive at the final having not lost a game all tournament. And actually now I feel reassured by those blips against Sri Lanka and Australia and obviously Pakistan earlier, that it feels, I mean, this could all be people to be absolutely wrong, but it feels like they've kind of got that out of their system.
Yeah, well, there have been different losses, which has been really helpful as well. They've not lost in the same way each time. They lost to Pakistan really through poor fielding. I mean, they let Pakistan get just 20, 30 runs too many. And even then, when they were chasing it, they probably should have won. They lost wickets when they were closing in on the chase. So they would have come out of that game not feeling too bad. So they said, you know, if we catch our catches, if we, you know, actually field the way we can field, then no side's getting that score. Then against Sri Lanka, they lost through timorousness, through not approaching that target with anything like the verve and gusto that they have for the last 4 years and for the other parts of this tournament. So they're able to say to themselves, well, that was a bad idea.
Yeah.
So you've got a different lesson to learn. And then against Australia, well, sometimes there's not a lot you can do. If someone fires in swinging yorkers like Stark did at Stokes, you know, the short ball that got rid of Morgan, he wasn't scared of it. He just too big at him and went too fast. Mm. Sometimes you give credit to your opponent, and you also say to yourselves, well, we didn't, when we had the new ball, we didn't bowl full enough, so we didn't make the best use of the conditions that we had. So, you know what I mean? There's different learning points, and they've got a muscle memory of what does work. So I think they'll have a great deal of clarity of mind I just note that all of this time we're talking is as if it would be a good thing if England win the World Cup. And I sort of understand why from our listeners' point of view. But I also think that for a lot of the country now, having got to this final, being typically English, it's not really about winning anymore now. They've got the final and they're up against New Zealand.
It is now. Some if people England are just suddenly realising there's a Cricket World Cup going on, though.
If you lose to New Zealand, though, that is not humiliation. And sport is really about the avoidance of humiliation, in my experience. You know, if you support a football team and your huge rivals, or let's say, you know, your Sheffield Wednesday, you don't feel too dreadful if you lose a cup final to Walsall. You feel absolutely devastated if you lose to Sheffield United and you can't bear it. And similarly, if England were playing against Australia in the final and lost, that would be unbearably painful. But sort of losing to New Zealand?
Why they could lose.
That is why they could lose. Yeah. But also it's why I don't think English fans would go, oh no, we've blown our chance, and then be racked by it forever.
English fans perhaps not, but we do want these new fans who we're apparently getting, and a few might tune into Channel 4. They're not going to remember England losing to New Zealand. They might remember England winning a World Cup final.
That's if we honestly think that one game, what do you think, one game of free-to-air television is going to transform the landscape of cricket
watchers?
Let
us believe, Dan,
I don't even know what, I mean, I can't remember the last time I saw anything on More 4. Have you seen More 4? Like that's where they're switching to More 4 when the Grand Prix starts. Are people going to switch with them? Most people just kind of go and make a cup of tea and forget about it, right?
I guess it depends. What time is that happening? I guess it depends a bit on the match
situation. About 1 o'clock.
Okay, well, yeah.
there's an argument that... there's an argument that on a global perspective, the best thing that could happen is for New Zealand to win this. Because if England win, it will be, I think, 6, 7 tournaments in a row that have gone to one of the big three. And for New Zealand, who are... of the kind of the 10 full members of the ICC, the smallest by population, to not just reach two consecutive World Cup finals, but to actually win one, would be an incredible shot in the arm. It would be an incredible two fingers to the big three, and it would in many ways be the best story of all.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, there's no way you're going to tell me that the entirety of the world, with the exception of England cricket fans, wants New Zealand to win. I mean, that is definitely the case.
That's not what England are for, is it?
No, it's certainly not. It's not for being the neutral's favourite.
Well, one man who definitely wants New Zealand to win is Andrew Alderson, Kiwi reporter, who I caught up with earlier for his thoughts ahead of the final. Okay, Andrew, so we didn't get a chance to catch up after the semi-final win over India, so let's just quickly take you back to that. What an incredible match. When you came back on that second day, could you foresee what was going to happen there?
Look, I think there was faith to a degree, but not to that degree. I mean, you just would not expect New Zealand to have India. Look at that Indian batting lineup. KL Rahul, Rohit Sharma, Virat Kohli, and all back in the dressing room, 5 for 3. It was just, a dream come true for New Zealand cricket fans, Joe, to be fair. I mean, I think that, and then it was, 4 for 24 shortly afterwards. You had that Jimmy Neesham one-handed catch, which probably hasn't got the kudos it deserves because it was been overshadowed by the later Guptill run out at, and even the steepler that Williamson was under to catch the in-form Ravindra Jadeja. And they were all just such key moments in putting together what I would say was the best New Zealand performance of the tournament.
I saw a nice thing on Twitter, which I think, I don't know where it appeared in the New Zealand Herald, but it was a yes we cane. Doesn't really work so much when it's a spoken word, but you know, the Barack Obama thing in the New Zealand Herald with a picture of Williamson.
That was our esteemed publication, Joe, we were rather proud of that.
I thought that was the case, Andrew. It was perfect. It kind of summed it up all very, very nicely indeed. I just wondered, what was the reaction being back like home? How has the whole thing been received?
Oh, look, it's frenetic back home, Joe. Just hearing from various sources, I'm talking to various elements of the media, also family and friends, it's starting to pick up enormous momentum from what we've been hearing. And I just think that it was a similar sort of scenario to 2015 with what happened with Brendan McCullum leading the side in the manner that he did, that robust demeanour that he had. But this is very much, I think, in probably Kane Williamson's image. They've gone about it quietly. They've had a very measured and an approach that's almost gone under the radar in many respects. But it's heated up at home, that's for sure. And just getting some of the numbers back from work, it's certainly people watching, listening and reading about it as much as they can.
Obviously, the time difference is a bit tricky over there. The final will be, in the early hours of Sunday night, Monday morning. So people have work to go to the next day. How do you think people are going to be taking that final in? Do you think there'll be people taking days off work on Monday? Is there kind of allowances in New Zealand culture for sporting events like this?
Well, funny you should mention that. There's been quite a big trend actually already, and there's been a few stories on it of employers basically saying, look, don't worry about coming to work too early on the Monday.
Brilliant.
Just to make sure that you enjoy it and just soak it all up. And I think it's a great attitude, really. It's a bit of a one-off occasion, and there's plenty of cricket fans in New Zealand, and there's plenty of sports fans in general who tune in for the cricket, who perhaps don't watch it all the time but like to dip in and out. And on this occasion, they'll be dipping in, but they'll probably need some cheese on toast. They'll probably need to boil the kettle and make sure, or you know, at least like, get some coffee in them and make sure that you know, they get the duvet, bring the duvet out to the lounge and tune in.
With the All Blacks obviously dominate the sporting landscape in New Zealand, and rugby is the number one sport. But when the cricket team does something like this, does a World Cup final in cricket, can it compare to a Rugby World Cup final? Has it engaged the country in the same manner?
Oh, I would argue almost more so, Joe, on
really?
This occasion, because it's a rarity.
Yeah.
It's a rarity. You know, cricket is the summer game. Rugby's the winter game in New Zealand. Rugby's the number one game by some distance, but I think it's the disparity. And it's not so much in recent years, because New Zealand's performed pretty consistently on the cricket stage through the Heston-McCallum era and now into the Stead-Williamson era. But I still think that there's an expectation with rugby that it will happen regardless, whereas this is almost seen as a real bonus or a reward in many ways for sports fans that they've managed to get into this final. And to do it back-to-back World Cups is pretty extraordinary. So I think there's certainly being reflected on in great spirit.
One of the lovely things about World Cups is it can kind of catapult sort of everyman cricketers or unknown cricketers to another level of sort of stardom. Are people like Jimmy Neesham and Lockie Ferguson, are they now getting coverage across the press in a way that they never would have done before?
Look, I think that's true too, and because I think each of these players pretty much performed in some capacity to get them to this point, and they've established themselves in the team. They perhaps even before the start of the tournament weren't that established if they hadn't come into some form. But those are great examples of players who've pulled their weight and probably got the team to where they have. And I think it's the case too that there's a wiliness, there's a tenacity within that New Zealand team, and I think it's built through the camaraderie, and they're just a good overall team, if you like. Albeit there are a few stars there in the form of obviously Kane Williamson, Ross Taylor, and Trent Bolt, but others have come around to support them. And I think probably for Sunday's final, if Martin Guptill could get up, we've seen that outstanding run out he was able to produce in the semi final. But if he was able to get up and score some runs, that would be a wonderful way to cap off the tournament for New Zealand.
I mentioned this on the podcast after the New Zealand-India game, that it struck me the reaction of the players after that victory. There was obviously a celebration, but it was relatively muted, particularly from Williamson and Taylor, who were in the final last time. It struck me that this was, for them, it's a job half done. Obviously, they've beaten one of the tournament favourites, but that doesn't necessarily mean all that much unless you go on and win the thing. Have you got that kind of impression from being in and around the group?
I have. I think that there's very much a feeling of unfinished business, given what happened in Melbourne. I think it was the manner in which it happened, too. They were almost shell-shocked with that McCallum, the Yorker that Stark delivered to McCallum in the first over, the off stump, and that pretty much took a lot of the momentum out of the campaign. It was hoped, of course, that McCallum would go on and play one of those cameos at the top, and that would give New Zealand the momentum after going into bat. But I think that this time there's perhaps more realism about it and pragmatism. They know they have to do a lot of hard yakka first, because last time, of course, they were going through the tournament, they were on a roll, an unbeaten roll. This time it's been a bit more ebb and flow, but they've got to the right place at the right time. And I think that the extraordinary thing would be, too, having lost those three games in a row, to be able to turn around and produce the performance they did against India, that bodes well. But having said that, England as well, I mean, they've done superbly well, especially with that effort, just the juggernaut pretty much rolling over Australia yesterday.
Yeah, that was a pretty awesome performance from England when they needed it. Look, if New Zealand are to beat England in this match, how do you think they're going to do it? What's the blueprint? Is it going to be something similar to India, not to try and go for that big total, but just try and restrict the opposition?
Oh, I think so. I think they would just do exactly the same thing. If they were to win the toss, I suspect, I can't imagine that the pitch at Lord's would be too much of a minefield. I think the idea would be to bat, get some runs on the board and put pressure on again. And I think with what we saw from the bowling attack and the fielding effort from that match at Manchester at Old Trafford, they're definitely capable of doing it.
And just finally, you're at Lord's right now watching New Zealand train for the for the big day. I was around the team at the start of the tournament and they seemed just incredibly relaxed. Is that still the case now with this big match ahead of them?
Very much so, Joe. And I think one of the key things there, and one of the themes across the tournament, has been this this football volleyball that they play, and it seems to almost occupy them. I mean, they'd almost be an Olympic team by now, the way they're so dedicated to the cause. And it seems to be a really good source of camaraderie at the start of practice. There's obviously some rivalry going on there between the batsmen and the bowlers, and I think it's sort of divvied up and mainly along those lines. And I think it's fairly even. But that's been, I think it's just a good way to switch their minds off from the game as a whole, various times. But I think it's going to be a pretty light practice today by the looks of things. I think Williamson's already out of the nets, which is some indication. He's only been in there for about half an hour or so, which is pretty light by Kane standards.
Right.
So I think that they're probably just going to taper up and look to prepare. And they might go for a bit more of a training maybe tomorrow, but you wouldn't think so. It might be, you know, fairly low key from here. But lovely sun at Lord's out on the nursery ground. There's worse ways to earn a living.
Absolutely, there are, Andrew, and it's all set for hopefully a fantastic game on Sunday. I know you've got a press conference to rush to, so thanks ever so much for joining us again. Hopefully we can catch up after a thrilling final on Sunday.
Oh, I look forward to it, Joe. I mean, I think it's the best thing about it, from my mind, is that Cricket World Cup's going to have a new winner.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the key for me, that it'll be good for cricket as a whole, and for either of the nations that wins it, but also for the runner-up. I mean, it'll be a big boost for the cricket community and probably the sporting community and beyond for people's well-being. I think just seeing how people performing at this level. So I hope it's a cracking final in whole, and you know, there'll be that new winner, which is pretty special.
I couldn't agree more, Andrew. Thanks so much for joining us, and speak to you soon.
Lovely, Joe.
All right, so those are the thoughts of Andrew. Now we're going to have a kind of wider overview of the tournament so far, and each pick out our not necessarily best player of the tournament, but our favourite player of the tournament, and also our favourite commentator. Dan is not allowed to pick himself for this one. These are the rules.
Have you been doing it, Dan?
Barely. Yeah, I would have drifted probably, but you would have noticed it because you'd have watched TV, won't
you? Yeah, it's all on. There's vision these days. They do it with pictures.
Yeah.
And you actually see what's happening, even though you're not there.
So these aren't real commentators, are they? They're just commenters. Because commentators have to tell you what's really happening.
Oh, is that the difference?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Dan. Which favourite players have stood out for you?
It's unfair of me, but I want to pick three, so I'll go through quite brief because I've chosen the good, which is Shakib Al Hassan, without doubt the world's best all rounder. He's got 600 odd runs. He's taken 11 odd wickets. He goes at 5 runs and over. Bangladesh is a good side, but without him, they would struggle.
Yep.
There'd be a much, much poorer side without him. But I think this Bangladesh side has sort of been put on the map in a way that previous ones haven't. I think you see them coalescing behind a few big name players, Tamim Iqbal, Mushfiqur Rahim, but primary among all of those is the fantastic Shakib Al Hassan, who's also hit some of the shots of the tournament. His on drive has been ludicrous. The bad, I want to go with Gulbuddin Naib, and I say bad advisedly. I love him. I love him for
You're
the
going
ambition.
For him again, are you?
It's the ambition of his reach. I mean, here is a man who was parachuted in to be captain at the last minute.
Just been replaced, I believe, today.
He hasn't.
I think they've gone back to Asghar Afghan.
Really? Well, what a surprise.
It's Rashid in all formats, isn't it?
I saw a tweet earlier saying this is what was going to be announced. I haven't actually seen the full announcement.
I think it's Rashid Khan.
Okay.
Well, that would be
a
mistake.
Because he was T20 captain, wasn't he? And he's got the whole lot now.
Get Asghar back because he did all the team talks. So he's come in at the last minute, presided over a fitful campaign, to put it mildly. There were moments of humiliation interspersed with moments of real potential. They were on the verge of beating Pakistan, and my moment of the tournament is with Pakistan needing 48 off 5. He brings himself on, goes for 18 runs, then brings himself off, and then needing to defend 6-7 off the last over, brings himself back on. I mean, that is a triumph of hope over experience that I just want to take my hat off to. And then there's Shaheen Afridi, who, had he played from the beginning of the tournament, I wonder if Pakistan wouldn't have sailed through to the semi-finals, because they looked fantastic with him in at the end. He can't field and he can't bat, which is another thing I really like about him, but he bowls at an extraordinarily magnificent speed. 91 mile per hour, fast in swinging Yorkers. He's only theoretically 19, 20 years old. We might get to see a Pakistan young fast bowler appear in two consecutive World Cups, because normally they arrive and disappear, don't they? Rahat Ali, whatever happened to him,
yeah,
among many others. So you asked for one, I've given you three.
And your commentator?
Well, there can be only one, Joe. He stands head and shoulders above the rest. as he dissects the conditions, the moon, the stars and the sun in perfect coalition, as he, along with Brian Waddle, has been the voice of New Zealand cricket. If you tell me which Welshman that is, it's of course...
That's not a bad Jeremy Coney.
It's not a bad Jeremy Coney, Joe, not bad. Yes, I absolutely love him.
He's a fun man to work with, presumably.
He threw away the word velocipede the other day. He was describing somebody running between the wickets, and he said, a noted velocipede, and then continued talking. I mean, he described one caught behind as looking like Boris Johnson ushering a flock of geese into an abattoir. I mean, these are metaphors and words that are just beyond reproach. And he is the loveliest man to work with. He's a very intelligent, erudite chap, and he's got beautiful voice and beautiful use of language. And I adore him, and he should be on every broadcast of all things.
Yeah, actually. He sounds like he'd be very good on the telly.
He wouldn't waste his talents on the television.
Jonathan, your player and commentator?
I'm going to go for an Asian player as well, actually. Bumrah, Jasprit Bumrah. I think he's so compelling. He's so good to watch. It's been a tournament for... I mean, people talk about the low score, relatively low scores, whether it's conditions or pitches. I think we're actually in a golden era of fast bowling, and some of the fast bowling has been just like astonishingly good. And Bumrah, I think, you know, just about at the top of the pile. I mean, he's got this kind of this quality to him where first of all, he's not just one great fast bowler, he's three. So he's a brilliant new ball bowler. He'll extract whatever movement there is. He takes wickets with a new ball, he comes back in sort of the middle overs, bowls back of a length and dries up the runs, and then he comes back in the death overs, and he's got this incredible array of bouncers and yorkers and slower balls. So he's got everything, all the attributes. But what he also has now, which maybe he didn't have 2 or 3 years ago, is the aura. And I never saw Joel Garner play live in the flesh, but when people talk about Joel Garner as a one-day bowler, he had when he comes on to bowl as a batting side, you would think, let's just see him off. And Bumrah's, and I can't think of many other bowlers in world cricket today who you could say this about. When Bumrah comes on, you go, let's just see him off.
Yeah.
Like, three off the over and no wickets is a decent result. Like, even when Stark comes on, you think you're going to get one to hit, who's probably his closest rival in terms of an all-format fast bowler. And, you know, it's the weird action, and it's the kind of... The weird hoppy run up. He's a star. He's got star quality.
It feels like teams are almost now seeing him off at the death, which is a ridiculous place to find yourself in, because they just can't hit him. So as you say, they'll take four or five singles in the last five overs and instead target other bowlers instead, which is an extraordinary place to find yourself.
I think your Garner analogy is perfect. It's exactly what it is. I did see Garner in the flesh, and it was a case that you always looked at the number of overs he had left and go, well, 2.5. We get 2.5 and over off that. It's slightly different because it's different times. But in terms of Bumrah, you're doing much the same. You double it, I suppose. If you get 5 and over, if you can get your bat on it and get through for singles, you don't ever in your mind's eye know how a batsman's going to hit him for boundaries, do you? You can't see the ball, but Bumrah bowls, it goes through a boundary.
You only hit a boundary off Bumrah if he lets you.
And he would have taken a lot more wickets in this tournament if it wasn't for the fact that, as you say, teams are seeing him off. What is his record? So he's taken 18 at 20 and a commonly of 4.41, which when he's bowling pretty much all his overs in the power play.
And at the back end,
that's pretty extraordinary. And your commentator, Jonathan?
I'm going to go for Brendan McCullum. Out of my hundreds of hours sitting on the sofa in front of the telly, I've actually quite enjoyed the telly coverage. And it's not often you can say that. Obviously, it's the kind of the ICC's pooled feed, and you often get kind of a mishmash. But they really, I think, upped their game this time. And McCullum, some of the kind of analysis segments that he does, which are obviously kind of a takeoff of Sky's Third Man, that kind of thing, have been really, really good. And I suppose the wider point here is that the evolution of the white ball game in the last few years is such that there's actually very few commentators who can still talk about it with a kind of authority. I mean, I love Michael Holding, for example, but what on earth does he know about, you know, bowling a back of the hand slow ball or bowling to Glenn Maxwell or something like that?
Yeah.
And McCullum, having kind of been in the international game a few years ago, he's sort of got that first-hand knowledge, which is really, you know, really invaluable these days. And he conveys it well. He's got a genial manner. And I remember one of his analyses, I think it was one of the Indian batsmen, of the different shots that you can play to the same ball. And, you know, pulling that kind of analysis out within a few minutes of, you know, of the action actually happening. I think he's one to watch. He's a real star in the making.
My player was actually going to be Shakib, who I think, if Root or Williamson score a
match-winning 100 in the final, then perhaps they deserve player of the tournament. If they don't, I think Shakib should be player of the tournament. He won't be, because he plays for Bangladesh, and Bangladesh finished, what, 8th in the group stage. So you could argue that he doesn't deserve it. But to carry his team in the way that he has, batting at number 3, scoring 600-plus runs, taking a number of wickets as well, and doing it all in a very, very stylish manner, I think he's... I knew he was a very, very good player. I didn't know he was quite this good. So he's really kind of raised his game. Lockie Ferguson was another one I was going to pick out, who we've talked about already. And on the commentators, we've got a Kiwi trio. I was going to go for Ian Smith, who I thought his calling of the semi-final climax in the India-New Zealand game, for me, I was really involved in that game. I mentioned every episode, it seems, my dad's a Kiwi, so I feel like I've got 2 feet in the final. But I thought, for me, that was right up there with kind of Ben 005, Edge Baston, Ian Bishop, 2016, Eden Gardens, as obviously emotionally involved in it, but also having just enough detachment to do it in a way that wasn't kind of too jingoistic or patriotic, and actually just painted a picture in a way that, to be honest, it's a bit more like listening to radio commentary.
He was brilliant, wasn't he? He got it absolutely spot on, and simultaneously on the radio, because I've dug out his and I listened to Coney's as well, and both of them, their voices just ever so slightly cracked.
Yeah,
Coney nearly went.
Did he?
Oh yeah,
I haven't heard Coney's.
It was beautiful, but he didn't quite. And you can forgive it of them, don't you think? I mean,
definitely.
You can so much more forgive Kiwi commentators getting deeply emotionally invested because of just the magnitude of their achievement, in a way that it just wouldn't feel right, would it, somehow, if Sourav Ganguly was getting
chopped off his shirt again on the balcony and starts waving it around his head.
It wouldn't, or indeed, you know, an English commentator, it just wouldn't be right, really.
I got the distinct impression he was trying to jinx it. He was trying to reverse jinx it in the final overs.
Ganguly?
Smith.
I mean, Smith. Well, he called India as favourites.
Yeah, India were favourites, and they needed something like 37 off 16 balls or something. Like, are you sure about this?
But that's what happens when you've lost that many semi-finals, as New Zealand had. I know my dad would have been saying exactly the same thing at exactly the same time as well.
He captured it. He captured it beautifully.
Yeah, it was great. So, final on Sunday. You'll be there, Dan.
I will, yeah.
You're commentating.
I'm commentating it for... you might listen to this, because it's Australian radio. That's worth giving it a go. So I'm doing it. It was wonderful. I did the semi-final in Australia, England-Australia, for SEN radio. I got the opportunity to be supremely patronising at the end. You know,
it's
a
great day to
Australia, get Australia have come a long way. They've done awfully well. They've probably exceeded their expectations. But
Most improved team award.
I'd like to think that after today, that there's a few things that they'll realise that they've got to work on and learn from this England team, and maybe come back in 4 years a bit stronger, and hope that they can challenge some of the bigger teams.
So exquisite.
It was great fun. And I intend to do something similar if England do beat New Zealand. So it's on SEN radio. I urge you to listen, because it's where commentators are unleashed.
And Jonathan, do you get a day off being a dad?
Hopefully, yeah. My accreditation is still pending. Right. Have they come through yet?
Some of them have, some of them haven't.
Oh, Jesus. So. Well, I mean, when I checked this morning, mine was...
I'd
like to think so.
Although they haven't just let you into the Oval, so hopefully this isn't the start of things to come.
Well, if not, I'm taking baby down the pub, and we're going to watch it with a pint of some pork scratchings.
Well, that sounds lovely too. So, winner either way.
One thing to remember, though, is that listen out for commentators who are going to try to tread the right... get the lines right, because if England do win, and they say, in England have won their first World Cup. Well, of course I haven't, because women have won it now three times.
Well, you'll have heard me in the intro. In fact, you won't, because I recorded it before you got here.
Right.
First World Cup in 2 years.
Yes, exactly. First World Cup in 2 years. First World Cup at Lord's for 2 years. And making sure that, you know, you get this absolutely spot on. The men's first World Cup victory in cricket, or something like that. It's going to be...
keep an eye out. If anybody gets it wrong, immediately.
If it goes wrong, there'll be a Twitter storm. So, yeah, we've all been practicing.
Okay, well, I'll be back on Sunday with Phil Walker and whoever else we can get our hands on at Lord's to look back on the World Cup final. This has been the Wisden Cricket Daily Podcast in partnership with Travel Bag, creating holidays packed full of memories since 1979. Thanks, Dan, and thanks, Jonathan, for joining me.
A pleasure.
Thank you, John. Appreciated. The Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast will be continuing beyond this tournament, including regular shows during the Ashes, so do subscribe on Spotify or any other usual platforms that you haven't.